Hi, everyone. Just a reminder that this show is not legal advice, trading advice, financial advice, or personal advice. Enjoy the show, and thank you very much. This show is sponsored by Anything Up, when you need another pair of eyes. And by Simple Contacts. Easy, fast, reliable. That's it. I'm done with it. I'm done with society. I'm done with governments. I'm done with taxes. I'm done with everything. It's just driving me crazy. I'm going to go make a floating island and live by my own rules and just use crypto. Yo, yo, this is Matthew Aaron of Crypto 101, the average consumer's guide to cryptocurrency. And today, we have a company that is doing just that. They are making floating islands in paradise that use cryptocurrency. I don't even know how to explain this, but that's why we have on Randy Hankin and Mark Collins to talk about it. But before we go into that conversation, please go to crypto101podcast.com. That's crypto101podcast.com. Follow us on our social medias. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Send us an email. Say what's up. I apologize if it takes a couple days to get back to you. Been really busy lately. Also, when you're joining the Facebook group, please remember to answer the questions. Those questions are there to know a little bit about you and to make sure that you will not spam the group. It's very important to us to know that our group is going to be spam-free, fraud-free, and scam-free. So, without further ado, let's learn about living on a tropical floating island with cryptocurrency. We'll see you after the show. Mark Collins and Randy Hankin, welcome to Crypto 101.
Thanks for having
us. For having
us. This is Randy.
This is Mark.
Hi, guys. Mark and Randy, you guys are doing something really special. You're incorporating blockchain technology. You are incorporating technology that a lot of people don't even know about, and that is building floating habitats. And on those habitats, the transactions, the spending, your day-to-day life will be using digital assets or cryptocurrency. Is that correct?
What I like to say is that we're trying to create decentralization in the world of atoms, where most blockchain decentralization happens in the world of bits. So we're trying to create floating communities where people will have enough autonomy over themselves because they live on a floating vessel that they can sail from one location to the other. People are going to have to wrap their heads around this and imagine and probably even go to our website to see pictures of this. Mm-hmm. But our big idea is that thousands and then millions of people will live on these floating cities. And when they're living on these cities and they can rearrange their homes and rearrange their cities, they'll have more choice than they have currently in how cities are arranged, and we can decentralize.
Excellent. Awesome. Let's first go into a little bit about you guys. We'll do a little bit of history, and then we're going to go into these floating habitats, how they're built, the tech behind it. Then let's go into the economies of the habitats and maybe the future. What do you think?
Sounds perfect to me.
So Randy, could you please just introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. So my name is Randy Hankin, and I'm one of five managing directors of Blue Frontiers, but I've been the executive director of the Seasteading Institute. Think of the word homesteading, but seasteading. Our big idea was we were going to go create nations at sea. So how can we start the very first floating cities with some autonomy to make it interesting for the people that want to pioneer seasteads? And I decided, why don't we try to do this instead of out in the open ocean? Let's do it near shore, behind a reef break or in a bay, someplace where we can basically build, you know, large floating houses without having to build for the open ocean. And we get a deal with a host nation to allow us to have some autonomy. At the same time, my good friend and colleague at the Seasteading Institute, Joe Quirk, who wrote the book about seasteading, realized that all these people who were attracted to seasteading had many different reasons, and they were bringing lots of technologies to the project that were interested in pioneering sustainable and important practices that can make humanity better in terms of how we fish, how we make energy, and how we survive rising seas. And we researched this project called the Floating City Project for several years. And eventually Mark, who is now our business partner, reached out to us from Tahiti and said, have you considered French Polynesia as a location for the first floating islands? And Mark invited us down to French Polynesia in 2016. by 2017, we signed a memorandum of understanding with the president. And from there, we launched Blue Frontiers. And I should let Mark tell his part of that story.
Mark, you were the Minister of Tourism of French Polynesia from 2007 to 2008. That's interesting in itself. Mark, could you please just tell us a little about yourself?
Thanks, Matthew. Yeah, that was a short period in my career. I've mainly been in the private sector, but in French Polynesia for many years. So my family's from there on my mother's side. I spent more than half my life in Tahiti. So as Randy mentioned, I reached out to him and Joe in May, and I had read, I think, the piece in Wired magazine. There had been a lot of coverage about the project. As Randy mentioned, the idea was to find a host nation. And that spoke to me because in 2009, 2010, I had launched an ISP. So Tahiti's first challenger internet service provider in Tahiti. And the reason we launched it is because there was a submarine cable, finally, a submarine cable connecting Tahiti to Hawaii and therefore to the backbone of the internet. We're no longer just doing satellite internet. And I figured that with this cable, with our location, the fact that we've got a very friendly population, friendly government, I figured this could be a good place to propose for the Seastain Institute. Randy put together a team. I think 9 people came down. We went around the islands, met the government, and basically got everybody excited. And there's a number of aspects of the Floating City Project that are fascinating. The one that caught my attention, and also I believe a good part of the government, and specifically the president, was about sea level rise adaptation.
When we came down there and we're saying we want a place where we can, you know, try an innovative society, where we can, you know, in large part govern ourselves. It's not that that was super interesting to, you know, the government of French Polynesia. What they're interested in is what technologies can you bring here to help us be resilient to rising seas? You know, what's the economies that you can bring here? And since they had something that we wanted and we had something that they wanted, it allowed us to come together and make this this partnership.
You guys said a lot right there. So let's actually back up a little bit and start at the beginning of the project. I would assume that this is the beginning. Is finding a place to make these seasteads. What goes into finding a host nation? What is the conversations to be had when you say, hey, how you doing? What do you guys do? Oh, we're going to build this big floating island over there. And they're like, what do you mean? So how do you go? And then once you guys have your floating island, your seastead, and you want to pitch this to, say, other governments, what is the process and what are they looking for and what are you looking for out of a location?
I would even go back even further to the beginning just to make it really apropos for your audience. In 2008, when the Seastain Institute was founded, is the same time that Satoshi released the Bitcoin white paper into the world. And in 2011, when I joined the Seastain Institute, that was the first time I ever heard of Bitcoin. And around 2012, the Seastain Institute took a donation from one of our donors of 100 Bitcoins. And at the time, Bitcoin was $20, that was worth about $2,000. And I proceeded to sell all of that Bitcoin when, you know, a few months later at $50, thinking I had done a really good job. right. In 2017, after we started the company Blue Frontiers, that same donor wanted to invest in Blue Frontiers. And he invested $250,000 into Blue Frontiers.
Right on.
And Bitcoin was $2,500 at the time. So his investment was 100 Bitcoins. So between 2012 and 2017, the difference in 100 Bitcoins was that significant. But to me, what's really interesting is that seasteading is part of this zeitgeist of people who are interested in creating a decentralized world, who are interested in pushing forward this next sort of economy. And if I were to believe in some kind of mysticism of Bitcoin, I think that we both came into the world at the same time. There couldn't be a better time for us to develop seasteads now that there's all this new wealth amongst these kind of people who appreciate this kind of society and governance. And it wasn't my intention to evade your question about how do you get started, you know, with a you know, going to a host nation. But it's important to recognize that we started even before we thought we needed a host nation. Mm-hmm. But when we realized that we couldn't go to the open seas and just build our own nation, and we had to have a relationship, we did years of research, and we investigated different countries that could become potential host nations, what the customer is like, what does the customer want in a seastead, and, you know, what's the engineering for building the very first seastead? So we've been working on this for a long time. You know, French Polynesia is a great location. I give it a 95% chance that it'll work out there, and Mark can speak to that more in a moment. We've also identified 51 other nations that we think are suitable for having to be in our host nation. And the major criteria is that, one, it's a relatively nimble government. It'd be very difficult to do this with a very big, laborious government like maybe the United States or Russia. You're trying to get up there and ask them for, you know, to create a special economic zone for us. That'd be very difficult. Mm-hmm. So working with a smaller nation is easier. Two, we need to have protected waters where we're not going to get destroyed by hurricanes. Mm-hmm. Three, we need to be, you know, someplace where it's safe. We don't want to be in pirated waters. Mm-hmm. And four, we need to be able to access the internet. This is just super important. So as Mark, you know, mentioned the submarine cable a second ago, it's a pretty important issue because there's several South Pacific islands that would be, you know, suitable for us, except they don't have good internet. And since the major base of people interested in pioneering the first seastead are people who are knowledge workers, people who trade in cryptocurrency, mm-hmm. We simply can't be on, you know, satellite internet. So the fact that there's a cable running to Tahiti and then out to the other islands makes Tahiti a suitable location. I said it's a 95% chance that we'll end up in French Polynesia, but we've always wanted to expand beyond one nation. And on that 5% chance that it doesn't work out in French Polynesia, we are looking for other locations. We're working with our partners to run a contest to inspire entrepreneurs to get us other agreements with other governments where we could have seasteads. The ultimate winner, somebody that can take us all the way up into a government and get us an agreement, could win $100,000 from us, as well as being a business partner on a future seastead.
Cool. So that goes on to a lot of what you're looking for into a country, to put a seastead there or have a partnership. But what is the government looking for? Why is this advantageous for them?
Islands, whether it's in the Pacific, the Caribbean, but islands worldwide historically have been technologically underserved. We don't necessarily get the best technology that the rest of the world is deploying. And being small, it is an advantage if we can get really good tech. And the fact that the Seastead Institute was started in Silicon Valley and had access and a very large network, international network, not only of supporters, volunteers, but also of technologies, was very appealing to the government. So basically, all of the technologies that we need on the floating island are also useful on the regular islands. I'll give one example. We're going to be doing floating solar panels. Well, you know, Tahiti is also interested in solar panels for some of the outer islands. We're interested in any sort of system that allows us to treat water on board without having any effluent, any gray water or black water in the lagoon. So basically all of our environmental approaches are interesting. The other thing is, I guess, the focus on sea level rise. Our president in 2015, so a year before we approached the government, had made a big announcement that led to language being included at the COP21 mm-hmm. on the importance of oceans. So French Polynesia, with other leaders in the Pacific, actually it's a group called the Polynesian Leaders Group, did play a role in bringing attention of the plight of smaller islands with sea level rise. So if by accepting and by working with Blue Frontiers, you can attract researchers, scientists, and just attention. And here's another one that for me, and especially as a former government minister, was important, is brain drain. We suffer, like a lot of islands, when our young students go overseas, go to Stanford, Harvard, and have some great educations, and then don't come back because right. they don't have right. the opportunities. So reversing brain drain and having a project that just people can get behind, can get excited. I mean, there's a lot of hope around the fact that, okay, we know as Polynesians that we're not about to stop the water, right? We're not going to go down the path of Miami and buy, you know, $500 million worth of pumps. That just doesn't seem, mm-hmm. you know, sustainable. So you need to adapt. We're a people, the Polynesians, that have always adapted throughout the last 1,000 years. We've sailed across the largest ocean in the world. And if it's a matter of adapting with nature, we'll adapt. But this is just one very interesting solution is to build your infrastructure on the water while taking care and being a good steward of the ocean.
I lived in Big Island, Hawaii. I went to University of Hawaii, Manoa. And when I think that from an island point of view, I see that you will have or invite a lot of foreigners, non-native to the islands, over probably rich, affluent people to the island and maybe use the resources or just have this floating island off of the main island somewhere. And how are the locals going to view that? How is everybody? Okay, the government can make the deals, but then the locals are going to be looking at it like, what the hell is this? Is that a concern or not?
Well, there's very, very important ways we've dealt with. One, you really need to understand what's in it for that particular community. And you're right. The government can say this is good for the country as a whole, but then the community where you're going to end up going to needs to really understand and be on board. So one of the things we did several months ago is announce that this isn't an enclave of a bunch of wealthy Silicon Valley billionaires. That's not at all the project. And one of the very tangible ways is to include the Polynesians and include them not as employees of the floating island, but actually on the same level as everybody else. So on the pilot, we've got 200 to 300 people that are going to be living on it. And everybody agreed that we should prioritize 25% of that capacity for Polynesians. I think that could be very interesting in terms of, you know, exchanging experience. If you lived on the Big Island, you know that the locals usually know a lot about their island, and it's good to keep an eye on what the locals do.
Right, exactly. All right, so we went through this. We have our host nation. We have permission to put the islands there. We have our mix of people who are going to live on the island. Now let's talk about daily life. Let's talk about the island itself, the tech, how they're going to transact, what's going on the island. You said that you're going to be using solar, or you're going to recycle your water. You're going to do all these things to make this like a little ecosystem so you can just live on the seastead. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I mean, one thing I think we should do for your listeners, who it's probably just hard to imagine what these guys are talking about. They haven't seen a picture. Let me describe a little bit.
Perfect.
So what we want to build is these modular floating islands where they connect. Like, maybe imagine rectangles and pentagons, like a jigsaw puzzle to get pieced together. Mm-hmm. And each one might be about 25 by 25 square meters. And they could have two or three stories buildings on top of them. And those could house up to 30 people apiece. Some might have, you know, single family residencies, and some might be, you know, a dormitory style living situation with hotels or, you know, Airbnb. What we can do, you know, once we raise the funding, is that we can build the first few, and then we can sell more. And as the city grows and changes, we can adjust and move from location to location, or spread out and try to adjust people's well-being.
So these little pieces move then.
Yeah, we plan to anchor them, not with an anchor that drags across the bottom of the floor, but some kind of tension line that holds them in place.
Right.
But you certainly can detach them and move them around. So they're literally floating. You know, this is really a key to our technology, is that we're able to move.
So I bought my little island. I kind of dock up there. I'm hanging out. A couple months goes by. My neighbor is just an ass, and I got to move. I got to move to the other side of the floating island. I can do that?
You could do that. Your neighbor is one of these jerks that just plays terrible music all the time, and you just don't want to be with him, and you move to the other side of the island, and then your neighbor is like, I don't want to be with this guy, and he moves to the other side of the island, and eventually the guy with the really bad music is stuck by himself,
right.
And he has to move his island away, and he's not bothering anybody, and he's happy because now he can play his really bad music and
all
face
by
it away
himself.
From everybody else. Exactly.
Right on. Yeah. Cool.
So how do we build these islands? We build them most likely out of concrete. And people, concrete, that doesn't float, but it actually does. It's just a matter of displacement. And concrete's a really good material because we can put it into the seawater, into salt water, for hundreds of years. And that's what we want to build. We're trying to build long-standing, sustainable floating islands that are good for the environment, and you're there. You're living there. And it's going to be there for your kids and your grandchildren. So it's a big concrete casing. And then inside of that, we put high-tech, seaworthy technologies, and we install black water systems and gray water systems that don't pollute the lagoon. And we're conscious about the materials we use and the energy we create. And the beauty, if we're in the tropics like Polynesia, is that there's plenty of sun and there's plenty of rain. We'll be able to, you know, have sufficient energy and enough energy to run our servers and to mine our crypto. And the beauty of today's world is that because of the internet, we can stay connected, even though Tahiti or Polynesia, the other South Pacific islands, are relatively isolated around the world.
Right. I guess the obvious question now is, we're going to go into the daily life of these islands in a little bit, but why islands? I mean, why not just like a patch of land in Montana somewhere? Why build an island?
Well, you know, a patch of land in Montana is still part of the U.S. government and the state of Montana, and you can't, if you buy into it and you get stuck to it and you get that bad neighbor, well, you're not going to pick up that piece of land. So at best, you've got to sell that piece of land and go elsewhere. we're really just part of a movement of people that care about the oceans and care about this philosophy of floating. There's really two things that Blue Frontiers is trying to address. And one is innovation in governance, and the other is innovation in floating technologies. What we're doing is we're going through the front door, working with the government, letting them know, you know, from the beginning, these are our requirements, and we're being reasonable. We're not asking for something unreasonable. We'd like to be able to be in charge of our own economic affairs. Mm-hmm. We want to be in charge of the kind of regulations that aren't going to damage things around us. We're a bunch of peaceful volunteerists. We understand that we're not going to have our own criminal code. We appreciate that we can dial in. You know, we don't have to build our own army or anything like that. We don't want to hurt anybody around us, and we know we can't pollute their country. I mean, it's their country. We're not going to destroy their lagoons, but let us try this other stuff. And what I want to see is the innovations that are built on top of this, because what excites me is what human potential can be unleashed once we have more innovation in governance. And one of the things I talk about a lot is that how important rule of law is to people's well-being. And we can measure that in countries that have good rule of law, there's better well-being. And we want to be part of an evolutionary process that creates better rule of law and more innovative rule of law. So, right, I can imagine on our seasteads using blockchain-based governance, measuring people's well-being using a hybrid artificial intelligence system of decision-making and providing better decision processes, where instead of us all having to, you know, take time to try to vote for something we don't understand, we can let the technologies that are available to us bring more happiness and more well-being to the people that are in our cities.
And now a word from our sponsor, Anything Up. Hey everyone, it's Anything Up, a blockchain project from the Netherlands. I hope you're enjoying Crypto 101 podcast. We've been developing a platform over the last year that we are very passionate about and we wanted to share with you. With the Anything App, you can quickly connect with someone you don't know yet to get help from them over the phone. Some of them will help for free, while others might charge a small price. You can call, chat, video call. Don't know how to fix something? Cool. Just video chat the handyman and ask. Don't know which pants to buy? It's all right. Video chat and show a stylist. Do you have a quick tax question regarding your crypto? Sure. Just ring someone for 2 minutes instead of Googling for hours. Taxes, business development, food, mental health, furniture, you name it. Whenever Google is too slow or you need another set of eyes on something, that's the Anything App. With Anything App, people save time. People solve problems. They make money. They feel great after helping someone or feel great after being helped. It's a transparent and fun source of income that's available to anyone. Check out the website, anything.app, and join the token presale, which should be live right around now. Thank you very much, and we're looking forward to disrupting communication together. And now a word from our sponsor, Simple Contacts. Yo, this is Matthew Aaron, and I live in Taiwan, as you guys know. So when Simple Contacts reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to try our service? I was like, ooh, I live in Taiwan. And they're like, oh, and I was like, I'm a contact wearer. I would love to try it, but I got somebody for you. I'm going to send you Danny Amsalem from Decryptionary. And so he tried the service. After trying the service, we talked on the phone. He said it was easy. Went online, did a vision test, cost him $20, renewed his prescription, then found the exact contacts he always buys and got a couple boxes sent to his house in a couple days. Just a reminder that this vision test is not a replacement for your full eye exam. But if you need some contacts quick, go on there and boom, get it done. This is a very easy and amazing way to get contacts for the summer, for your baseball games, your football games, your camping trips, or just a drive in the convertible. And you're sitting at your desk right now, dreaming of outside and saying, I don't want to go to the store. Simple Contacts. It has been rated over 3,000 times 5 stars on the App Store, designed by doctors, and, well, you get $30 off by using my promo code. So, give it a shot. That's simplecontacts.com/crypto. simplecontacts.com/crypto. Promo code crypto to get $30 off. Check it out. I guess I'm still confused a little bit. And I think now we're going to bridge over into daily life on one of these islands. And My confusion is, you just said that you don't want to have a patch of land in Montana because it's still part of the United States government. You fall under the laws of Montana and what have you. At the same time, you said that you are going to be law-abiding to Tahitian laws. You're going to, you probably use their police force and other aspects, correct? So that means that you are following law and in participating into the French Polynesian system, but you don't want to in the state. So I guess there's a clear divide of what laws you want to follow and what you don't want to follow. And then once that divide is made, what makes you not evolve from your island to just say, hey, then I'm going to do my own thing and we're just going to have all kinds of islands of our own economies that are separate from the other islands because, you know, I don't want to follow laws. I guess where's the part where you guys are mutually working with a government and where's the part where you are your own thing?
It's an evolutionary process, Matthew. It isn't binary. It isn't we get it all or we don't get it all. If you look at the history of special economic zones, if you look at Shenzhen and Hong Kong, the government can test certain policies that they're not willing to do countrywide. So when we first presented this to the government of French Polynesia, we were talking to some of the top ministers and they got it. And that was part of the interest for the host nation, is that some of these policies are difficult. If you wanted to change the labor code, for example, French Polynesia's labor code is very similar to France's labor code, which is quite restrictive. So if you said, if the Minister of Labor in Tahiti said, hey, we're changing our labor code from one day to the other, it'd be very painful and there'd be people out in the streets screaming. But if you were to say, let's set up this little zone with Blue Frontiers and we're going to test this, it's geographically limited. It's limited to very few people, but we can watch and learn. So that's one of the reasons why a government is willing to forego certain rules. But it's an evolutionary process. I mean, the ultimate goal is to go, you know, outside of the special economic zone of any country and be in the open sea. But we can't make it out there if we haven't tested all of these technologies, whether they're social technologies, mm-hmm. Whether it's about energy, water. So mm-hmm. That's why we need, so it's just the first step, if you wish. It's a baby step to start in a protected water, but ultimately it's to go to the open seas.
Okay. So you just said you wanted to go outside of the economic zone. This is the main goal, is to go to the open seas. I guess I am not understanding the motivation still of the people living on this island. What is the motivation? Is it, we said a lot of good words. We respect the ocean. We recycle. We do all these things. But what is the other things that are driving people to these islands?
There's two, as Randy mentioned. One is the fact that people aren't necessarily happy with the country they were born into or the passport that they carry and the rules of the country that they live in. So you're seeing more and more of these movements worldwide where people feel more in tune with these international tribes. And you're seeing more and more people that are wanting to live together in certain types of new societies, but without necessarily the boundaries that, so there's a movement around that. Now, to your question about why islands and why not do it, and I got this question a lot in Tahiti. Tahitians are quite pragmatic. And they said, well, why don't you just bring us all that cool tech and we'll just deploy it on our main island? Why don't we do that? Mm-hmm. Why create a new one? So the other aspect then is sea level rise. And that's one that mainstream media is not really talking about, and not enough, at least in my for my taste. The reality for a small country like French Polynesia is that one third of our islands, and a lot of these islands are inhabited, will disappear, or at least will be uninhabitable by 2050. So this is the latest data. So this is really just an absolute disaster. I mean, if you can imagine, 32 years from now, you're going to have to figure out where to move people, and they're very attached. So Kiribati is the poster child of this issue, because they actually only have 33 atolls. They don't have high islands. And they have one that's kind of a high island, but it's not sufficient. So what they're doing is that they're actually buying land in Fiji. So the previous prime minister bought land in Fiji. And New Zealand now has a special visa for climate refugees. So when you speak to their prime minister, this is a real issue to them. They lose their sovereignty. We've never had a situation like this in history. So having at least the hope that this technology will evolve in the next 10, 20 years to where humanity is going to, I mean, that's the real ambition, is humanity living peacefully and sustainably on the ocean. And we're talking about food production. We're talking about everything, a new way of farming on the ocean, algae, maybe growing steaks from protein.
you know, as Mark is saying, he's speaking from the from the viewpoint of the Polynesian, and I'm not a Polynesian. I'm, you know, born in the United States. I'm talking to you from New York right now, where we've been attending Consensus, you know, one of the largest conferences on blockchain and cryptocurrencies. And I've been walking around this, you know, 9,000 person conference wearing my Blue Frontiers T-shirt. And every little while, somebody walks up to me and they see my shirt and they're like, hey, you're with Blue Frontiers. I'm totally into this. I totally want to come live on one of these islands. You're doing the most exciting project in cryptocurrency and blockchain space. How do I get involved? And what's cool about it is our first project is designed for hundreds, and then there'll be thousands. And we don't have to convince, you know, the entire world to come move to floating islands. We're serving a specific market of people. For the billions of people who live in places that want better rules and want more opportunity, and maybe even they're in places that with pretty decent rules. I mean, I don't want to complain as an American. I mean, it's, you know, pretty good here compared to elsewhere in the world. But there's many Americans who feel that they want new opportunities and how they innovate in their governance. Mm-hmm. And I just don't believe that I could get that started. You know, being a U.S. citizen. You can't take me to Montana and get me a plot of land and all of a sudden have innovative governance. But the Polynesians are brave enough to say, let's work with you and see what can happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's go into, we talked a lot about government. We talked a lot about the ideology in those aspects. Let's go into living on the island. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's going to be like to live there, how the day-to-day life is going to be?
That's going to be part of the excitement, and a lot of the people that are signing up for this, that is the big question: is what is a society like this, if you want to call it that? It's small; it's 200 people, but how do we live together? So, what nationalities? Do we share energy? Does each person pay his fair share?
And I can paint, but I think very exciting. I sometimes feel funny when I share this vision. What's my life going to be like when I move to the first seastead? Well, I have my bedroom is underwater, and I got a picture window of the lagoon. So I get to see the fish swimming by as I sleep, and they're looking at me like I'm the aquarium. I get up in the morning. I do my yoga on the deck. If the wind is up, I go out for a kite surf. Mm-hmm. Then I probably eat some fish from an aquaculture pen, eat some seaweed as well. I'll probably get on my computer, check my crypto portfolio to make sure that things are going okay and I'm not too stressed out today. Interact with my neighbors. And then at night, as the sun sets, we'll be able to look out at the beautiful sky, sit around, you know, on our rooftops. You know, just great conversations with people from all over the world. You know, as the people that are attracted to the project are a brilliant, forward-thinking kinds of people that you always have a good conversation. I always have a good conversation when I get down to talk with these people. In some ways, the situation will be drastically different as we're floating and figuring out these technologies and making sure they work and experimenting with blockchain governance. In other ways, it's going to be a lot the same, just with awesome people in a beautiful place.
Right on. So who's working at the 7-Eleven? What's their life like? I mean, I like the yoga, and I like
the... When you're a small village, you have so many companies, and when you're a big, giant city, you have a lot more companies, right? Mm-hmm. The beauty of where we're choosing to be, there's regular shipments that come in. You probably don't need a 7-Eleven for 300 people. You need some kind of decision-making system to make sure you have enough supplies every week.
I guess the question isn't about the amount of people, but I'm wondering where the average person is. Because you said yoga and all these good things and checking crypto portfolio. Well, not everybody has a crypto portfolio that doesn't make them worried. Where's the person unloading those shipments living? Where's the person that is maybe making your cocktail? What's the average person looking like on your island? And how are they transacting? How are they getting paid? What's their hours look like?
Sure. So I don't know what average means. I know that like any society, it takes all shapes and sizes. And in our society that we're preparing is going to be as welcoming as we can of all shapes and sizes. And we're actively avoiding having a class system where some people are just servants and others are taken care of. I see the people who are involved so far, if I were to put a word on them, it's a duocracy. These are doers. I wouldn't necessarily call us collectivist, even though Mark might like to, but I would say that we're cooperating and we're volunteerist.
Okay, cool. Excellent, excellent.
And whoever doesn't work at the 7-Eleven on his day of the week, we send them off to the other side of the island. So
that's my question. I mean, and I'm not trying to, you know, be skeptical, but I am trying to understand what life is like, because I guess we've all been to a resort on Hawaii, like Kona side. Let's just say you have, you know, but you go to a resort on the Kona side, right? You are paying a lot of money to stay in the resort. And the people that are working there are looking at you as like, oh, this person is paying a lot of money to stay at this resort. We work for them. But you just said, yeah, people are working on their days in 7-Eleven or unloading the docks or what have you. So this is, everybody is doing their part?
It's one system, and it's a great question. And these are the sort of questions that our token holders and the people who will ultimately come here will have to answer. And that's what's exciting. I mean, how does a society structure itself where you, it's not about everybody is exactly equal, and how do you structure? We don't have a plan where people are coming from the main island, and I've seen that in some resorts, and where all of the workers come in at 7 a.m. and leave at midnight, and you've got this the system. That's certainly not the vision. But we do have to figure out whether it's labor, whether it's education. I mean, there's a number of things. And again, that's the exciting part. We've got 2 years at least between the engineering and the construction to figure out. And there are parts of our volunteer teams that are sitting down right now figuring out, okay, how do we tackle this? And it's a fascinating questions.
Randy, do you have anything to say to that?
We're not here trying to centrally plan people's day-to-day lives. You know, we want to see what emerges.
Right.
You know, for us, this is a wonderful opportunity to experiment with this. I anticipate that at least in the first, you know, society, we'll have a lot of people that just do.
Right, right. Cool. That was exactly my question, is how are you going to, you know, manage the involvement into the island? Because things are going to have to get done. The work is going to have to be done. The trash is going to have to be taken out, you know, and who's going to be doing that? And just from my point of view, those are the interesting parts of your project, is how is everybody's going to work together? Yeah, thank you for answering that question.
Yeah, sure.
So what I wanted to mention, I mean, is we've got this young team, as I mentioned, in Tahiti, that sits around also and thinks about how they're going to fit in. But I'll tell you what motivates them, because we've had all sorts of discussions as to why they want this. And one of the things is exposure to new ideas. Having a group of international thought leaders and just some really interesting people coming in is extremely stimulating for some of our youth. And for them to say, look, I'm going to live on this island, do whatever it takes, because I want to be exposed to these ideas and maybe participate in some of them. Basically, you get this idea that the world is shifting, that things are changing very rapidly. And for small communities to be a part of that and bring their contribution to this is very exciting. And I think the Polynesians will contribute a lot. If you think about the migration of Polynesians throughout the Pacific, they had to live on a canoe for months on end and get along. And, you know, I've been talking to some of the elders and trying to figure out what were the systems and what were the rituals and how did it work. These are 1,000-year-old ways of thinking, and it's going to be interesting to see how the two meet.
Right on, right on. Would you mind if we go into some general questions?
Please.
Excellent. Who are some people you look up to in the crypto space right now?
Personally, I've been in the crypto space for many years and have had the opportunity to travel all around the world and see how quickly it's grown. I'm just going to talk about the advisors we have on our team. We have a guy named Yuri Lobansitz, who started Syndicator, and he's a brilliant, you know, guy out of Russia, out of St. Petersburg, who's interested in artificial intelligence. And I had the opportunity to spend 3 weeks with him living together in Tahiti. He gave us advice, and we now have a partnership with his company, Syndicator, and we're planning how we can use their artificial intelligence hybrid technology for decision-making on the future of floating islands. We have a gentleman named Daniel Nagy, who's an Ethereum developer, cryptographer, who's really helped us understand the power of Ethereum and the smart contract. We have a partnership with Zencash, and one of their founder, Rob Viglione, as well as his wife, Rosario. Together, these two, just in this last year, created Zencash. They wanted to create a currency that had, you know, better privacy aspects, but then a whole company around the Zencash model, a whole platform for people to have more autonomy in their own data. So we're lucky to have, you know, Rob and Rosario as advisors, or, you know, Zencash's partners.
Right on. Actually, they're going to be on the show on the 28th.
Yeah, lucky you. They're amazing
lucky
people.
Lucky me.
There's another one. There's a guy named Dorji Sun. He's been involved in several different projects, one called Santiment. He also has been named Hero of the Environment by Time Magazine, and he's one of our advisors. There's a guy named Majesty Olowski out of Poland, who's been involved in Bitcoin since 2011. And together, this team has advised us on how to put together our own cryptocurrency that we're using to fund our own project. So ultimately, we have a cryptocurrency called Varyon, V-A-R-Y-O-N. It's a play on variation in governance. And that's going to be exclusively used by Blue Frontiers. If somebody wants to buy an island, rent an island from us, lease a unit, register their business in our C-Zone, pay their utilities to Blue Frontiers, they would need to use Varyon as the token of our economy. So this is available. People can buy this. I'm not going to talk deeply about it on your show for you, but people should check it out at Varyon.io. This team of brilliant crypto people have helped us put together this project.
Right on. Mark, what about you?
I've spent quite a bit of time, like Randy mentioned, we had the opportunity to invite our advisors at different times to Tahiti, and I was there full time. So whether it was Yuri or Dr. Daniel Nagy. Now, what I really appreciate about our advisors and Daniel in particular is basically that the code, they live on the whole on code and the transparency and how clean it is and how efficient it is. And out of that comes a sort of ethos that even goes further than just the code is, how do you treat the token holders? Once you start talking about transparency, it changes your relationship to everything. We also had a chance about several months ago to spend an hour and a half with Vitalik on the phone call. And you can't not be impressed when you hear a guy like that. Basically some of the questions you were asking, he was asking, and we're going back and forth, and you can see how quickly, and they've got a filter. They're looking at society and finance and human relationships through a certain sort of, what is everybody calling it, the truth protocol. So it's really interesting. I mean, philosophically, it's brand new. I mean, disintermediating, the banks, who doesn't want to do that?
Right on. Yep. Crypto 101 is kind of positioned to be one of the first places people are going to look at when they come into this space. The name says it all. So if this was one of the first podcasts somebody getting into the space was listening to, what advice would you give them, Randy?
Wow. If this was the first Crypto 101 podcast they ever listened to, one, they're going to be like, wow, that's a really crazy crypto show.
True.
So aside from HODL, which they hopefully know what that means already, I think that the world is moving to crypto. I'm bullish on the long term of crypto, but I think people need to also be wise. Until we get to a place where people really start measuring crypto with crypto and it's not measured against the dollar, don't put all of your life savings into crypto. But put enough there to ride the waves and don't watch too closely because it's unnerving. But I think that, another few years from now, eventually we're not going to be measuring crypto against the dollar. One of these stable coins is going to come up. People are going to be talking about Varyon, just to plug our own crypto, as a really important one because it's what people use on Seasteads. I think that we're going to see crypto get easier, right? And I'm seeing it already. I'm seeing the technologies that have been born in the past few years, and we're at a place now where people younger than me can adopt it pretty quickly. And I think that the big flipping point will be when people older than me are able to adopt it as quickly.
Mark, what would you tell them?
Here's one takeaway, at least through this new mode of funding, you're basically aligning your users with the company's objectives and the guy's financing and funding you. And that is very different from Wall Street. I mean, that's very different from an investor just saying, hey, I like Apple or I like Samsung or whatever, and I'm going to buy it. But it's not the end user. So basically your end users are really the guys. And it just creates a sense of community that it's just blowing me away just with our own project. So basically people are putting their money where their ambitions are, where their dreams and hopes and aspirations. And it's really very, very different from just saying, hey, look, I'm buying stock in this and in that. So the fact that the community, that I find super interesting. And the other thing that struck me and the difference for a startup going the crypto route or the ICO route as opposed to VCs. If I were a young startup company and looking at both deals on the table, you really are going to take a hard look at this one. And it's not about the fact that there's a bunch of liquidity and a lot of people think there's just stupid money out there and that it's easy. It's not about that. It's just that your access to capital is just insanely easier. I think Zao talks about 100x. I mean, 100x difference. And I think it's coming true. I mean, if you look at the VCs, if they're starting to invest into crypto, that kind of is a big sign.
All right, right on. Gentlemen, is there anything else we should touch on the C-studs?
I'll add a few things. One, I just want to, Blue Frontiers is the only company in the space that's legitimately trying to make C-studs. There's other people who've had crazy ideas like ours. We've got, you know, more than 100 professionals working on the project, more than, $1 million this year behind us, $2 million underneath the C-Study Institute, you know, a decade of work behind us. We understand the delicate balance between having a crazy dream and what it takes to make that dream practical. So how it is for us to work with the government to find a win-win situation where we can, you know, have some kind of autonomy interesting to the residents of Seasteads while still being respectful of the host nation, and how we can build the first floating islands in a way that are practical, affordable, sustainable. We're setting up systems, or if people are listening to this show and they're like, I never heard of that, or I heard of that before, but I didn't know I had a way to get involved. They can be token holders, but beyond being a token holder, they can participate in our teams and part of our global movement. So we have ways for people to plug in to the community pretty much today and be actively involved in our community. And whether they want to come live on a Seastead full time, you know, as soon as we build one, or be on our base camp with us next year, or whether they're just thinking far out into the future and they know that, a decade from now, this is an opportunity they wish they could have be a part of. We're doing what we can to be as inclusive as possible for these kind of people.
Right on. Mark, you have any final thoughts?
Yes, thanks. I just keep coming back to the big meeting we had with the government in Tahiti and what caught the president's attention. As a politician, especially when you're the leader of your nation, you do have to think of the future for your country. We're not hearing this sufficiently, I think, in Western media. And that's the fact that sea level rise is going to impact 10,000 communities worldwide. Don't think just Miami and Shanghai and New York and small little Pacific islands. There are 10,000 communities out there. And another figure that you're starting to hear slowly, trickle up is this idea that it's literally going to be the world's largest construction boom over the next 30 years. So 30 years is not that long. And we're talking, depending on which experts you speak to, anywhere between $100 to $200 trillion worth of infrastructure. I'm not saying that the only solution is, just make floating infrastructure for these cities. But of the four solutions that a city or a government has to deal with sea level rise, we're definitely, I believe, the least expensive. I mean, it's less expensive to do this than to move all your population somewhere else. It's just completely, historically, this never has happened before. So moving people is not easy. Backfilling the ocean with a bunch of sand and dirt is a really bad idea environmentally, and even the cost is high. And not everybody has money like the Dutch or the city of Venice to build, $6 billion dams and huge public works. So I think you're going to see more and more talk about floating infrastructure. Singapore is an example. They're talking quite a bit about it. You're going to see a movement in the next several years where, people are going to be trying to figure out what to do, when faced with rising seas. And very quickly, we're going to find out you just can't fight. You've got to adapt.
Right on, gents. All right, gents.
Matthew, I want to congratulate you on the success of your show. I want to let you know that I think crypto is the future, and I think it's great that you've taken this on to educate people. And I also want to thank you for really giving us the time to have an in-depth conversation. I think that too much media is too much sound bites, and the opportunity to have this long conversation with you to be asked tough questions is really appreciative. So I hope that you learned something more. So I hope your audience learned something. I look forward to anybody who is excited about the
project, reach out to us. They can find us at blue-frontiers.com. If they want to know more about our cryptocurrency, it's varyon.io, varyon.io. You know, really, congratulations, Matthew, for being a great host and doing a good job for the world.
Thank you very much for that. I really appreciate that. Good luck with Floating Cities. Hopefully, you invite me out to the Floating Cities so I can hold up at your bar, buy a cocktail, and go down to 7-Eleven and get some Doritos.
I look forward to having you as a neighbor.
Sounds good. All right, Jets. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks,
Matthew. Good night.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Crypto 101. As always, apogeecrypto.com, that's apogeecrypto.com, the best place to check your real-time prices. Cryptonews.com, the best place for your news. And if you need a website, wponthefly.co. And as for June, next episode, we have Zencash, or they're going to rebrand and call themselves Zen, and we're going to learn about their project. We'll see you then.